My voice tends to get really low. I have a soft voice anyway. And so if at any point you can't hear me, just kind of give me a little high sign and I'll kick it up for another two or three minutes and then it'll go back down. But I'd much rather have you do that than tell me later that you couldn't hear, because then I'd be sad. Or maybe not. We'll see how it goes. So good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Welcome to Zen Center. A number of people have been asking me lately about a contemplative practice that I do called sitting with sutras. And so I'd like to talk about that this morning and talk about contemplation and meditation. And I'd like to start out by defining my terms. By contemplative practice, I mean working with a text or an image by taking it in with a quiet mind and observing it with your heart. Then letting it stay with you, kind of on the periphery of your attention while you meditate, and maybe even continuing on later as you go through your day. There's a description from St. John's Abbey that I like. It says, "Cease from interior spiritual doing and learn simply to be. In contemplative practice, we simply allow a text or image to interact with our interior world of concerns, memories, and ideas." So we have this text or this image, and it interacts with our interior world. Someone pointed out that this is similar to what you hear about scientists and mathematicians doing when they'll be sort of puzzling through some impossible problem that nobody has ever figured out before, and then they just put it down and walk away, and the next morning when they wake up, eureka, they've had some kind of an insight about that. Or maybe that's happened to you too. You just haven't gotten worldwide acclaim for it yet. So that might happen, and it might not happen, but that's what we're doing when we're doing a contemplative practice. In Zazen, on the other hand, sitting meditation, there is no object that we use. There's no word, there's no image that we're using or sitting with. In Soto Zen, we practice just sitting, shikantaza. Sitting upright without clinging. One time, Tim gave a whole talk that I thought was just wonderful. Panoramic awareness. I like to think of it as panoramic awareness. Choiceless awareness. But there are definitely no words in Zazen. No words in Zazen. As Bodhidharma famously said, Zen is a special transmission outside the scriptures. No dependence on words and letters. And that was preceded and followed by centuries and centuries of Buddhist texts. So, in Zen we have a real push-pull kind of relationship with words. Poor Bodhidharma. So I'm actually not interested at all in changing or altering the way that we meditate. I think Zazen has a long history. It does not need my help. But once in a while, I do also like to do a contemplative practice. And that's what I want to talk about today. There are a couple of sort of cautions that pertain both to contemplation and meditation. In both of them, it is not unusual to become kind of goal-oriented. You know, imagining that there's something that we can achieve using this technique. But Zazen and contemplation are not techniques. You know, we should let go of wanting anything from them, expecting something in particular from them. anxious, striving kind of zazen never got anybody anything but more anxiety and more striving. And contemplation is about listening or taking in and then gently holding, not seeking some particular outcome. If there is an outcome, it will be much lovelier than the one you could have imagined anyway. But there isn't going to be one necessarily. But if there is, cool. Don't go searching. So that's one, being goal-oriented. And the other one is that you should try to avoid the urge to assess the quality of your zazen or your contemplative practice. You know, this is not a performance, and we're not competing with anyone. Most importantly, we're not competing with ourselves. There's no one to compare with. The important thing in both of these is just to make a sincere effort. So even if you know that the person sitting right next to you is probably in deep samadhi, right on the edge of a huge enlightenment experience, there is no need to compare your terrible, never going to get me anywhere but, you know, another 12 kalpas of lifetimes. There is no need to compare or to assess. So sitting with sutras. About 12 years ago, I learned a contemplative practice called Lectio Divina from the Benedictine sisters, Benedictine nuns. Is there anybody here who's done Lectio Divina? One, two, three. I heard that we have some high school students from Holy Angels. I'm going to tell Kevin if I don't see any hands from you guys. Or I'll tell him you were so shy and well-mannered that you wouldn't do it. So anyway, I learned Lectio Divina. And I decided, and I was taken by it immediately. It's a meditative practice. And I recognized that at its core, the meditative component of it seemed about this far away from zazen. It was very close to zazen at the core of the meditative part of Lectio. And so I decided that I'd like to adapt it for a Buddhist audience. And I worked with it for a little while, and I knew it needed a name, so I called it Sitting with Sutras because I like the alliteration. And I led several afternoon sessions of Sitting with Sutras. The last one here was in about 2008. And then I didn't do it for a while. I don't know why, but last September, Norman Fisher was here giving a workshop on working with koans. And he really opened them up for me by using words like contemplation and rumination. And he provided a fresh way to approach them. And that led me back to sitting with sutras. So I took it up again. And last month I led an afternoon of sitting with sutras, and I'm going to lead another one next month. I like to do it in the winter. It seems to go well with winter because the windows are closed and the snow kind of makes everything really quiet. And there's something about the quiet of winter that seems to help people's ability to settle down into concentration and contemplation. So I like to do it in the winter. And when it's quiet like that, it helps people with this kind of listening. You know, in our everyday lives, which are often kind of noisy, we often don't take time to listen at a deep level. And there are a couple of things that are obstacles to listening deeply or hearing well. And one is our ego, our identification with the false self. You know, that self that we have up here in our heads that separates me from you and attaches to our own ideas and has a complete world of its own that's separate from the complete world that you live in, right? So that really gets in the way of our listening. And the other thing is that usually, often when we're taking in information, while we're taking it in, we are forming opinions. As we're listening to something that somebody else says, as we're reading, we're forming opinions. And Fran Lebowitz has a wonderful quote about this that I've used many times here. She said, "The opposite of talking isn't listening. The opposite of talking is waiting." And I think it's really true. Imagine in a conversation the number of times you've just been kind of waiting for the pause so that you can jump in and say what you want to say. So, we aren't so good at listening sometimes. But if we can let go of those kind of hindrances, we may be able to deepen our ability to really listen. To really listen. And to receive, which is very different from taking. You know, receiving is like this, you know, and taking is like this. Contemplation is about receiving. Meditation, on the other hand, is about being. But in both cases, we practice without being concerned about what we're going to get. I'm going to get me something out of this meditation. No. I'd like to give us an abbreviated experience of contemplation this morning using the poem that's on the bulletin. Who doesn't have a bulletin? I've got some extra copies of the poem. Pass those out. So here's the process for sitting with sutras. We use a short quotation. Sometimes they come from the sutras. Sometimes they come from other sources. This one is an excerpt from a longer poem by Katagiri Roshi that's called The Peaceful Life. And what we'll do is I'll ring a bell, and then we'll all read the selection out loud together. And as we read it, try to read it with a listening heart. You know, feel open to receiving it in a personal way. In a personal way. So we'll read it out loud together. And then, after that, just read it to yourself, slowly and quietly. And as you read it that time, see if there's one phrase in there that sort of pops out at you. That happens a lot of times. This one phrase will kind of pop out at you. So, for example, in this reading, maybe the line, "Just practice right here now," would pop out at you. And then, so you select a short phrase to sit with. So maybe you sit with "Just practice here right now." It isn't a discursive practice, so we aren't thinking about it too much. What does that mean? What's he talking about there? That reminds me of this other, you know, da 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 da. So we're not thinking about the words. So it's a good idea to select some words that you aren't real likely to build a storyline around. So if "just practice right here now" had popped out at me, I might narrow that down to "just practice right here." I probably wouldn't use "practice right" because then I'd spend the whole time going "practice right." I practice wrong. Do right-wing people practice? I don't think so. You know, so try to get something that you aren't going to go off on. Having said that, you're going to be able to go off on just about anything, I can tell, right? But remember, it's not a contest. So anyway, so read it quietly to yourself, slowly, taking it in. And then if something pops out at you, use that for your sitting. And if not, just take a few words out of there that you can use. So then we'll sit for 5 minutes. And what I'd like you to do is just hold the phrase with you, sort of in the periphery of your attention, you know. Some people experience this as holding it in their heart. Some people sort of hold it in their mudra, in their hand position. You know, maybe they hold it right there. Some people hold it in their hara. When I do it, I experience it as holding it just over my right shoulder here. It's kind of like Tinkerbell right there over my shoulder. But in some way, try to get it in or near your body so that it's nearby. And just as with Zazen, if it drifts away, kind of gently bring it back. It's not a mantra. You know, with a mantra, you know, Om Mahan, what is it? Om Padme Hanme Hum something. You are repeating it over and over, and you're not doing that with this. You're not doing that with this. You're not reciting it. You're just keeping it nearby. So after our 5 minutes, I'll do a roll down. Roll down sounds like this. And that means that we have 1 minute left. And at that point, just let go of your phrase entirely. Just let go of it. And then I'll ring a bell about a minute later to end. So that last minute or so, we're just going to be sitting Zazen. And I'll walk you through this so you don't have to remember all those steps. Okay, so first of all, we're going to read it out loud together. What a mystery a human is. As to this mystery, clarifying, knowing how to live, knowing how to talk with people, demonstrating and teaching, this is the Buddha. From my human eyes, I feel it is really impossible to become Buddha. But this I, regarding what the Buddha does, vows to practice, to aspire, to be resolute, and tells myself, yes, I will. Just practice right here now and achieve continuity endlessly forever. This is living in vow. Herein is one's peaceful life found. All right, now read it silently and slowly to yourself. And if some phrase pops out at you, that's the one that you'll use. And when you have one, just sit with it. Just sit with it. And we'll sit for about 5 minutes. Now very gently let go of your phrase, and let's just sit for another minute or so in Zazen. Just upright sitting with nothing in particular, with everything. And that's the basic practice of sitting with sutras. When we do it here, we're together from noon until 3 on a Saturday afternoon. And during that time, we do several 30-minute sittings. And I add a little something different to several of them. And at the end, when we close sitting with sutras, I ask people to leave quietly without talking about their experience and to try to maintain that quiet mind and maybe keep the phrase with you for the rest of the afternoon. Usually at the end of retreats, a lot of people are sort of really interested in doing a lot of talking about it. And I like to have people, when they leave sitting with sutras, just keep that quiet. So let me see. You can also do contemplative practice with images. And the sisters that taught this to me call that Visio Divina. I don't really have a name for it. Sitting with images, maybe, I don't know. But in that visual form of practice, you view an image or an object at a more kind of contemplative pace, gazing at the image without judgment, with kind of a serene curiosity. And if you gaze at an image for a while, you'll start to see more and more things in it. You know, maybe you'll see forms, or you'll notice colors, or patterns, or shapes, or textures. Maybe it'll remind you of something. Just look at it normally, longer than you normally would, and stay open to it, and you'll be surprised at how much more you start to see in the picture. When I did it with the sisters, we used sacred images, and we sat as a group, and they projected the image up on the wall, and people would just say, "Oh, I see this, I see that." And it wasn't a discussion. It was just whenever some... And I thought this would take about 5 minutes. And about 35 or 40 minutes later, we were still finding more things in the picture. So it's a very interesting thing to do on your own or with other people. And then you can sit with it in the same way that you do sitting with the text. I want to point out something that's coming up here, Paula Arai's workshop at the end of the month in March. She's going to be coming here, and at the end of the day, she's included a contemplative, she describes as a contemplative candlelight viewing of a very large, very beautiful painting. You can see the picture of it out on the front bulletin board on the sign-up sheet. And I don't know exactly what her plans are for it, but I'm really fascinated to find out. I've seen her present before, and she is really terrific. So, you know, it might be something like Visio, or it might be something entirely else. I don't know, but I think it's going to be really extraordinary. So I would... Ted is smiling because he knows her very well, and she's a wonderful presenter. I had an experience recently with Visio that I kind of didn't expect. My husband and I were out of town for a couple of weeks, and we went to a photography exhibit. And the photographer's name was Alejandro Almaraz, and the exhibit was called Places I've Never Been Present. And it was an exhibit of public spaces. Most of them were cathedrals, some were mausoleums. There was the throne in the Forbidden City. And he had taken lots and lots and lots and lots of images of each one from the internet, or from private collections, or from archives and other sources. And one of them was Notre Dame. So he got, I don't know, 40, 50, 60 different images of Notre Dame, which is a place he's never been, and he overlaid them one on top of another. And they were all taken by different people at different times from different angles, so he had to kind of piece them together. And so it ended up, you know, and it's, some of the pictures were taken during church services, so in some of the pictures there were people in it, and in other pictures it was empty. So as he's layering these on top of each other, the images of the people look, they're translucent. It's almost ghostly. And the effect of this was almost, it was sort of a cubist effect, is what it ended up looking like. And it also kind of reminded me of time-lapse photography. You know, when you see a car at night driving by in time-lapse photography, and you see the lights. All you see is that. You don't see the car itself. You just see the lights. And I was just fascinated by it. I have my laptop along, so I'll set that up out on the porch later on, and you can see them because it's just hard to explain. But I was fascinated by them. And I stood in front of it for a long, long time, watching them, looking at them. And I wasn't really thinking about doing a contemplative practice, but they really stayed with me. And I noticed that when I sat after that, that I still had a couple of those images with me. And at one point, I caught myself thinking, that would be really interesting if we did that at MZMC. Because just imagine if they had taken pictures, you know, when we first got this building, of the Zendo, and then that would be overlaid with a picture of a different altar, and then overlaid with the altar after we redid it. The people would be set up in different ways on each layer of the picture. You know, in some layers it would be Katagiri sitting here, and some it would be Shahaka-san or Karen or Tim. So you have all these layers of a picture that were the same but had different elements in them. And then I caught myself thinking that and said, okay, that's fun. Now let's get back to Zazen here. But at the end of that period of Zazen, I walked out of the Zendo with a real strong sense of having sat with all the people who had ever sat here, all the people who had ever sat anywhere, all the people in our ancestor list. It wasn't something that I would have expected. and not something that I feel like I need to ever, I'm not going to sit down tomorrow morning and say, boy, I'm going to make that one happen again. But it was a feeling of great appreciation and solidarity and gratitude for all those people who have sat like this over the centuries. And it was wonderful sitting with, you know, multitudes of people in the Zendo that night. So, and as I said, I'll put up my laptop out there and you can see the photos that that were in the exhibition. And I think that's everything I want to say about, or everything I have to say about that today. In contrast to the afternoons of sitting with sutras, I'd be happy to chat about it. We can talk. So if anybody has anything they want to say or add or any questions... First learned visio from the sisters, it was an evening, and I think a phrase that we were, it was a biblical phrase that she gave us to read. I don't remember what it was, but I remember feeling maybe a little cocky when they sent us off to do meditation, because after all, I'm a Zen Buddhist and I know about meditation. And this contemplation is nice and everything, but, you know. And we sat for about 15 minutes. And at the end of that 15 minutes, I felt like I had just gotten out of 3 days of Sesshin, 3 days of long days of meditation practice. And I walked out of there just sort of slack-jawed and with big-eyed. And I went up to Sister Carol and said, "This is really amazing." And she said, "Yeah, it is." And I remember there was a big full moon that night. And as I drove home, it was a lot like driving home after Sesshin. I was just driving along, seeing this big moon, going, "Wow." And that's when I decided I needed to keep doing this practice. So I recommend it. Yeah.
You mentioned with the visio, you kind of notice different things as you're looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
You also mentioned it's not using words, it's you're doing a practice. Is there a way to use those two elements? Is there a way to notice things in English?
Yeah.
Quietly without using speech. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You can notice things in an image without making judgments about them, without you can just kind of take it in. And ordinarily, if you're looking at art, you might be thinking, "Boy, that really reminds me of Cézanne right there. I wonder if that was his, you know, influence." Or, you know, "I think I would use a different color of blue there." Or, "I prefer this." Or, "I wonder what's in the next gallery." Or, you know, on and on and on and on. And after you've done it for a while, you can pick out images that are really good for it. There's some that have a lot of... they have kind of a cohesive image, but there's a lot of details to them. And it helps to have something... I don't want to necessarily say spiritual, but I'd say something uplifting to it. So, yeah.
When you discern the texts with words, is there a text that lend themselves more readily and others that don't?
I try to look for texts that you're not going to be able to cling on to too much. So, I've used ones from the Diamond Sutra. I think Uji would be really good. Time being would be really good. I think the koans might be really, you know, some of the koans might be really good. That's the kind of things that I look for. Not too long, you know. But when I was doing it with the sisters, you know, they were using, like I said, biblical passages. And those worked fine for me, too. I just found things in them that I could work with. So, you know, maybe you try a totally different tradition. You know, maybe you get out the Quran or something. I don't know. So, leaves of grass would be good.
Yeah.
Thich Nhat Hanh has a book that does, I believe, I can't remember the title quite, but a moment of mindfulness, and every week he has written a passage that the contemplative practice of memorizing that passage kind of and coming back to it.
There you
go. On a weekly basis.
Mm-hmm. That would be great. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Gathas would be great, the short poems. There's one by Robert Aiken. When someone close to me dies, I vow with all beings to something and meet with them there. I forget how exactly it goes, but something like that. You know, if you have a scrap of a poem that really means something to you, and you can remember it better than I do, that works nicely. Yeah, Steve.
So yeah, I know it's like there's this kind of like, I don't know, mythology or trope or something about quote spiritual practice where it's like, well, you know, we're not really profiting or benefiting from this. But, and then that, it's like I was down in Hokioji and saying, well, you know, there's a lot of benefit from this from 6 days. So I do it another time, double the profit. Mm-hmm. And someone's saying, oh, you know, we just do Zazen. And they don't make any benefit. And I said, and you know, they said, that's capitalist Zen. So, but like I was thinking, like, okay, so if you did this thing for 2 hours or 3 hours with the sisters, it was like 3 days of Zazen, why would you just convert?
I was a Catholic for my entire childhood. I've put in my time.
That's the best answer possible.
I love the sisters, and I studied with them for a year, and they were absolutely wonderful. I studied with them for a year at the same time that I was preparing to become a priest here, and they knew that I was a Buddhist. And every once in a while, I would sort of go, is it really okay for me to be here? You know, some of the other people in my group were very religious in a traditional way. And every so often, I'd go to Sister Carol and say, is it really all right that I'm in here? And she'd say, I want you here. So it was wonderful. When I shaved my head, she made me stand up in front of everybody and talked about my ordination. I've forgotten what your question was. I evidently was not listening very deeply.
Yeah, I think you kind of answered some of it.
Cool.
So, how would you distinguish this from koan practice?
You know, the stereotype of koan practice is that it's very sort of rigorous and rough. And I'm sitting, you know, Bill Tresh described one time being at a Rinzai monastery, and people were doing the koan moo. What does a dog have Buddha nature? And the answer is moo. And he said he saw people up in trees going moo. And I don't mean to make light of koan practice, because I've done it. And it's wonderful. And I know that it's not all like that, right? But there also is an element of going into the teacher and presenting your understanding in koan practice. And then Tim hits you with a stick and says, no! Right, Tim?
That's coming up.
He said 50 Shades of Zen. So this is much more of an interior kind of thing, and what you hear about as traditional Rinzai practice, there's some great Kensho that you are, if not striving for, at least sort of hoping for. And with this, you know, in my experience, often something amazing happens, but it's like walking in the mist, you know. You like walking in the mist, and you don't know what's coming up. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I get it.
Okay. Anybody else? All right.